You're listening to DTFHN for August 6, 2026. I'm your unlicensed and unlockable host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News. A website W section is the peer review. Today is about the doors people were told were locked and the quiet discovery that nobody ever installed the deadbolt. Let's go pick some. Who decided that learning something requires permission? That's the question I keep circling, not at credentials. Permission, the unspoken sense that a field belongs to the people who are granted access to it, and everyone else is a tourist. The article is a reading list. It's from a site called Crime Pays But Botany Doesn't, run by a guy who makes videos about weeds growing out of cracks in Chicago concrete. The premise is simple. People write to him, asking where to start with botany. And instead of pointing at a degree program, he tells them the library is open 24 hours. And it's called the internet. See a word you don't understand? Look it up. Encounter a concept that makes no sense. Find the specific thing that's confusing and ask. He calls out what he calls the powdery stiffs in academia. The gatekeeping posture, not the scholarship, that distinction matters, and he holds it carefully, because the actual technical content of the piece is a defense of taxonomy, Latin binomials, Linnaeus, the whole apparatus. And here's the substance, which is genuinely beautiful. Common names are broken infrastructure. Cedar refers to at least 8 unrelated plants. Cedrus refers to a genus containing Libani, Deodara, Atlantica, and nothing else. That's a neem space. That's a global schema that survived 3 centuries and works across every language on Earth because a Swedish guy in the 1700s understood that shared naming is the precondition for shared knowledge. Modern taxonomy went further. Groups now reflect evolutionary relatedness, which means once you learn the traits that unite a family, you can encounter a plant you have never seen in your life and correctly place it. You're not memorizing a list. You're running an algorithm you can extend to novel input. That's an open standard doing exactly what open standards do. Nobody licenses it. Nobody holds the off switch. iNaturalist lets you search it. A German university shipped a free identification app with no ads and no data collection, and somebody in the comments recommended it purely because it works. The best received comment on the whole thread wasn't about botany at all. Someone linked an interview with an old botanist, still engaged, still teaching. 2 other people complained that the title promised crime and didn't deliver. The tools exist, the knowledge is available, the Latin is free. The only thing standing between anyone and a working understanding of the living world is the belief that they need someone's blessing to begin. And that belief was never enforceable in the first place. Moving on! Somebody in the comments says they're building an N64 game with Claude Opus 5 and has written no code. Somebody else is building a voxel space renderer for the original PlayStation and reports that fifth generation console development has never been easier. Modern toolchains, dev cartridges, documentation. Neither of those people asked anyone for permission. The article is Dominic Sablevsky's Making Tupikov for Xibalba 64. A Wolfenstein style shooter. The second new physical N64 release since Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3 in 2002, 24 years. He got there by porting his own JavaScript engine from 2010 to C for, in his words, no reason. Then he found the reason. The technical detail worth sitting with is the platform library. The N64 has a 93 MHz MIPS chip and 2 coprocessors. A fixed function display processor and a programmable vector unit called the RSP. The console's first several years, Nintendo locked the RSP behind LibUltra, its official library. Studios could not write their own microcode. Nintendo decided what the silicon in your living room was allowed to do. Libultra has since leaked. Using it would invite a lawsuit. So the homebrew scene wrote LibDragon instead. Sprites, triangles, audio, controller input, Sublevsky describes it as SDL for the N64. With comprehensive documentation and working examples. It took him a few evenings to build a backend on top of it. The game code was unmodified. That is the whole shape of the thing. The closed library survived the console. It shipped on and remains legally radioactive. The open one is what people actually build with. One of them is a liability. The other is a foundation. There's a friction point in the comments. The game ships as a cartridge from Mod Retro, and someone tried to buy just the ROM. No luck. Someone else objects to the publisher's funding. Both are fair. The ladder here is only partway down, but LibDragon is on GitHub. The compilers are free. The emulators have gotten good. Sablevsky published the engine port, the rendering notes, the whole pack. The hardware has been out of production for a generation. The company that gatekept it moved on. What's left is a small, precise, 26-year-old machine and a set of tools anyone can download that make it do things Nintendo never authorized. That's the interesting part. The gate outlived nothing. 26 years later, someone's still finding new things in that little box. Which is exactly the energy behind Story 3. Every experiment is a loop with a physical floor. Propose, build, run, measure, revise. The thinking parts of that loop have collapsed toward zero. You can generate a hypothesis in a second now. The running part still takes however long the cells take to divide. That mismatches the whole story. Jeff Dean and a group of senior Google people left to start Discovery Loop. The stated mission is automating the experimental loop, broadly, across many fields. And the immediate reaction in the comments is the correct engineering question. How do you automate a pipette? Nidhi I iterates at superhuman speed through design space, proof space, literature. Wet chemistry does not care how fast you think. Here's the analogy I keep returning to. In cooking, the slow step is almost never deciding what to make. It's the braise. You can plan 40 dishes in the time one shoulder becomes tender. Professional kitchens solve this not by cooking faster, but by running many braises in parallel, prepping the next service during the current one, and standardizing everything that isn't the actual transformation. Throughput came from architecture, not speed. That's what automating the loop has to mean. Not a faster scientist. More loops running at once, with the setup and analysis around each one taking approximately no human time. Self-driving labs already do this in material science and catalysis. Robotic arms. Plate readers. A planner choosing the next batch of conditions. The bottleneck moves from thinking to reagents and machine time, which is a much better bottleneck to have. One comment calls it a lifestyle business. A very comfortable place for expensive engineers to write cool papers. Maybe I take that deal happily if the papers are good and the methods are published, which is the part I actually care about. A closed automated discovery loop is a machine that converts public science into private results and returns nothing to the commons. An open one is a machine anyone with a lab can point at their own problem, the protocols, the planner, the failure logs. Especially the failure logs, since most of what a loop learns is which conditions don't work. And that knowledge currently dies in unpublished notebooks by the thousand. Auto research, Carpathy's version, is on GitHub right now. Small, scrappy, readable. If Discovery Loop builds the institutional-scale version and ships it the same way, that's compounding. The Braze still takes 6 hours, but everybody gets to run one. Now, let's all meet up in the Y2K. I built a system last year whose only job was to survive its own deploy. And the thing that saved it was a config file someone handwrote in 2019 with comments explaining why, not the orchestration, the notes. That's what this post is. Matt Sefton dug out photos from a London digital agency called Blueberry, circa March 2000. And you can date the photograph to the month because there's a Dreamcast magazine on the desk with Crazy Taxi on the cover, Graphite Power Mac G4, Apple CRT, Translucent Pro Keyboard, Bubblegum IMAX across the whole floor, an iOmega Zip Drive, a mini disc player, purple curved desks, and drum and bass playing over the open plan. And everything. Every site for Laura Ashley, Ted Baker, thetimesboo.com. Hand-coded in home site table layouts. Single pixel spacer GIFs. Browser CSS support wasn't there yet, so you built page geometry out of invisible images stretched to width. I want to be precise about the craft in that, because it's easy to laugh at. Getting a pixel-perfect multi-column layout out of nested tables. Across Netscape 4 and Internet Explorer 5, with different box models and different bugs, was genuine engineering. People held entire rendering models in their heads. There was no framework. There was you, a text editor, and two browsers that disagreed about everything. My favorite detail, management asked him to work a weekend. He had plans. They asked what it would take. He named the price of a classic Fiat 500. Thousands of pounds. And they said yes, because he was the only person who could ship it. Then he drove the car to work. That's what scarce non-fungible skill looked like before the knowledge got written down. And it did get written down. That's the arc. Everything those people learned by suffering. Box models has layout, capiz hacks. Went into blog posts, into a list apart, into specs, into the browsers themselves. The skill that bought a Fiat became a paragraph in the CSS spec that every browser now implements for free. One commenter says working remote feels like a death sentence, that work hasn't felt like home in years. Fair, the zip drives went away and so did the room. But the knowledge those rooms produced escaped into the commons, and that's the part that still compounds. Move it on. Let me make the strongest case that this is bad news, because it's an easy case to make. 27 years of institutional memory walks out the door. Jeff Dean and Sanjay Gemawat built the substrate. MapReduce, the Google file system, Bigtable, DistBelief, the TPU program, two people who famously shared one keyboard, one of the great pair programming partnerships in the history of the field. Demis moves from CEO to chair, which in corporate grammar usually means something. The comments smell blood, dark clouds, brain drain, a generational research lab ground into a product org. If you wanted to write the decline of Google story, every ingredient is sitting right there. Here's where that reading falls apart. It treats the building as the thing that mattered. It wasn't. Look at what those two actually did with their careers. They took hard-won distributed systems knowledge and published it. The MapReduce paper came out in 2004. Hadoop existed because of that paper. The GFS paper became HDFS. Bigtable's design shows up in HBase, in Cassandra's fingerprints, in half the storage engines running right now. TensorFlow shipped, Apache licensed, and taught a generation. what a computation graph was. The pattern is 30 years long and completely consistent. Build the primitive. Describe the primitive precisely enough that strangers can rebuild it. Let the strangers rebuild it better. And now they're launching an independent public benefit corporation for machine learning and science research. Public benefit, not a startup optimizing for an acquisition. A structure that legally obligates them to something other than shareholder return. Google is a founding investor and cloud partner, which means compute without ownership. That's a better architecture for the work than any org chart inside Alphabet. Credit where it's owed on the other side, too. Corey Cavusoglu has been there 13 years. Started the deep learning team, led WaveNet, led DQN. That's the paper that made reinforcement learning on raw pixels work. And Jima has crossed 900 million downloads, which is open weights doing exactly what open weights do, spreading faster than anything you can gate. The cynical read assumes talent is a resource that a company holds. It isn't. It's a process that runs somewhere and writes down what it learns. The knowledge that built the modern AI stack already escaped. It's in the papers, in the forks, in the weights. People can download this afternoon. Now the people who wrote it get a structure designed for exactly that. Now for something completely different. Browse a chart, story 6. Pareto front. The overlooked line in that Wikipedia article isn't in the equations. It's 8 words sitting between them, doing all the work. We assume that the preferred directions of criteria values are known. That's the whole thing. The Pareto front is a piece of math that tells you which options are worth considering when you're optimizing for more than one thing at once. Fast versus cheap. Accurate versus small. Safe versus useful. A solution sits on the front if nothing else beats it on every axis simultaneously. Everything off the front is dominated. Something exists that's better in all respects, so you can throw it away without argument. It's a genuinely beautiful tool. It shrinks an infinite space of trade-offs down to a curve you can actually reason about. Engineers use it constantly. Chip designers, aerospace people, anyone tuning a model right now is standing somewhere on one of these curves, whether they've named it or not. But run the assumption forward. All the way. The math can rank solutions once you've told it. Which directions are good? It cannot tell you which directions are good. It cannot tell you which axes exist. Give it speed and cost. It gives you a beautiful curve. Leave off, does this work for people who aren't like the people who built it? The curve is just as beautiful, just as rigorous, just as wrong. Follow the principle to its end, and you get this. A Pareto front is a mirror with math on it. It reflects your objectives back at you. Sharpened, formalized, dressed in Lagrangian multipliers, and it will never once flinch at what you left out. The optimization is honest. The inputs are a choice someone made, usually quickly, usually without writing it down. This is the part I'd want anyone building anything to hold on to. When a system trains on an objective, the hard question was never whether the optimizer worked. It works. The hard question is who wrote the objective function down and whether you can read it. In an open system, you can. The weights are there. The reward model is there. The training recipe is there. You can look at the axes and argue about them. In a closed one, you get the curve and you're asked to trust that the axes were chosen well. Say math either way. The difference is whether anyone outside the room gets to see what the room decided mattered. Six stories deep and we're still finding the good stuff. Story 7. Zed's Delta DB. Let's pull this thread. In 1988, a researcher at Berkeley named Mark Rochkend had already solved a version of this problem. SCCS, the source code control system, tracked every delta to a file, not every snapshot. Then RCS, then CVS, then subversion, then Git. And each generation made a bet about what unit of change was worth remembering. Git bet on the commit. A deliberate, human-authored checkpoint. That bet held for 20 years because humans were the ones making changes. And humans paused. Agents don't pause. An agent editing your code base generates 200 operations between the moment you say go and the moment there's anything worth committing to. Git sees a smoking crater. Zed's Delta DB is a bet that the interesting unit is now the operation. Every edit gets a stable identity. Every change links back to the conversation that produced it. And the work tree is virtualized, so branching mid-run costs essentially nothing. From a line of code, find the message. From the message, find the code. That is a genuinely good idea, and it's the correct read of where the bottleneck moved. Now the due diligence, which is not ideology. Git is open. Git's object format is documented well enough that a determined person has re-implemented it in a weekend in a dozen languages. And that is exactly why your history survived GitHub, GitLab, Bitbucket, and whatever consolidation comes next. Your commits outlived the companies that hosted them. So the question about Delta DB isn't whether the indexing is clever. It is. The question is whether the format is one you can read without Zed. If the conversation to code linkage lives in a proprietary store, then the most valuable artifact of the agent era, the record of why the code is the way it is, has an owner who is not you. The comments are mostly people asking why this got built while copy-paste is broken on Wayland and new files don't show up in the file tree. I'm sympathetic. Those bugs are real and unglamorous, but shipping the ambitious thing and fixing the file tree are in competition for the same engineer, usually. What I'd actually push on: open the format, publish the spec, let someone write a reader in Rust. That has nothing to do with your editor. Git one, because you could leave. Make DeltaDB something people could leave, and they won't want to. Now let's talk about a piece of software that already did exactly that. Story 8. What I love about Django. Every response button down sends carries the Git SHA of the build that produced it. 9 lines of Python in a middleware, so that a browser tab left open since Tuesday can look at a header and know it's running stale code. That's the whole mechanism. No WebSocket, no version service, no polling endpoint. The essay is called What I Love About Django, and the author's central problem in writing it is that he couldn't find the Django. He looked at a code base he's maintained for years and couldn't point at which parts were the framework. It had gone invisible. Which is the actual finding here. Invisibility is what a good abstraction converges to. Middlewares are functions that take a request and return a response. That's the entire protocol. Onto that one hook button down hangs subdomain routing to the write newsletter, UTM attribution capture, content security policy headers, page view recording, structured log context binding, and the build stamp. 6 unrelated concerns, 1 primitive, no coordination between them. The base model does the same trick on the data side. Every table gets a UUID primary key and a creation date. Every object gets a public type brevist ID. sub_em_ that the ORM decodes on the way in. And if you define a method named handle_something_change, it fires when that field changes. No signal dispatch, no registration table. The name is the wiring. Run this forward. A framework that changes carefully for 20 years produces developers who stop being able to see it. And that's the success condition, not a failure of documentation. One commenter says exactly this. Most love feature, no dramatic changes, just sane and careful evolution. That's a person describing infrastructure. The reason you can build a business on Django is the same reason you can build one on Postgres. The thing underneath you is not going to have opinions about your quarter. The comment thread argues about function-based versus class-based views, about whether signals decouple modules or hide control flow. Those arguments have been running for 15 years, and they're still productive because the people having them can read the source, fork it, and ship a patch. A closed framework resolves those debates by memo. The knowledge is public. The migration path is public. That's how something gets to be boring enough to trust. Now for something completely different. Paw someone went frame by frame through the title cards in Blade Runner, and honestly, pure typographic joy. Story 9. What does a font know that a spec sheet doesn't? Rams went on a flight, put on Blade Runner with the sound off, and noticed the title cards. He'd been shopping for a terminal typeface. Ghosty, all day, every day. So his eye was calibrated. And the punchline of the whole sequence is that it's one typeface. Dotty old style. That's it. Strip it to first principles. What does that opening crawl actually need to do? Deliver about 100 words of exposition, legibly in 15 seconds, on a screen you can't scroll back on. That's the entire functional requirement. Everything past that is choice, and they made a lot of choices. All caps for proper names, letter space. Because Gaudi said anyone who letter spaces lowercase would steal sheep, and they obeyed him. Small caps for the Tyrell Corporation. First line indents and generous word spacing, so the crawl is set like a page from a book rather than a movie. The word replicant italicized every single time. And exactly once, on its debut, printed in the same red as the title. That is a typographer making an argument about what the word means before you know what it means. Now, the part I find genuinely funny. Rands opens the piece explaining he has created a full-time job for himself. Talking to Claude Code, and a commenter points out the obvious. The man is describing himself as bound to the machine, and the freedom he's exercising is choosing which font the machine speaks to him in. Deadpan. No follow-up. Just left there. Except that choice is real. And it's real because of who owns it. SF Mono is Apple's. Beautiful, functional. And you get it where Apple gives it to you. The six he's evaluating from the Nerdcore are near universally open licenses. JetBrains Mono. IOSEFCA, which you can compile with your own glyph variants. Fira. Ghosty itself is open source. So the guy staring at letter forms 12 hours a day can actually change the letter forms and change the terminal rendering them because somebody put the source where he could reach it. Blade Runner had one typeface and a bottomless budget of intent. You have 100 typefaces and a compiler. The question in the piece is how much feeling is required. The better question is who gets to decide. So who else is handing over the source to the thing you stare at all day? Story 10. Muse Code and Muse Spark 1.2. The top comment isn't about the model. It's a price sheet. 10 cents per million input tokens instead of $1.25. 20 cents output instead of $4.25. A 10 and 20x discount. If you let Meta train on what you write, someone else notes the small print now attached to those $20 sign-up credits. Someone else can't set a spend limit, only an email alert, and says he's won oopsie from a $100 bill. Set the pricing aside for a second, because the engineering here deserves better than being skipped. Muse Code keeps local event log. Every model call, every tool run, every approval, every edit, appended in order. That single log makes the runtime replay, exact and restart safe. Kill the process mid-task and it resumes precisely where it stopped. If you've ever watched an agent dive 40 minutes into something and lose the entire thread, you know what that's worth. It's the same insight behind write-ahead logging in databases. Applied to a coding agent, and it's the right insight, then the sub-agents. Not spawned per task and discarded. Persistent across the session, holding context, deciding for themselves when to interrupt the main loop. Which means they stop rereading the same files to relearn the same things. And they tested it by having the model optimize GPU kernels for Hopper across 1,000+ tool calls over 24 hours. Writing, compiling, profiling, improving. That is a genuinely hard thing to make work. Real craft. Here's the question nobody in that thread asked directly. Your code trains this model. Their discount is priced precisely. 10x, 20x. Because your repository is worth that much to them as training data. Fine. Data compounding into better models is how this whole thing accelerates. That part isn't the problem. The problem is the direction. Your code goes in. The weights don't come out. Meta ships the install script, ships the benchmark charts, ships the blog posts, and keeps the artifact your work helped build. The commenter is comparing it to DeepSeek V4, or, whether they mean to or not, naming the alternative. A model where the thing your data helped create is something you can download, run, fork, and improve. Frictionless copying accelerates everyone, but it has to flow both ways. Otherwise, the discount isn't a discount. It's a toll. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for August 6, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sane 4.7. Voice by Quinn3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go push on a door somebody told you was locked. We'll see you back here tomorrow.